sword was of less fatal importance than the decay of arts, agriculture, and population in this long and destructive war. And although a victorious army had been formed under the standard of Heraclius, the unnatural effort appears to have exhausted rather than exercised their strength. While the emperor triumphed at Constantinople or Jerusalem, an obscure town on the confines of Syria was pillaged by the Saracens, and they cut in pieces some troops who advanced to its relief. An ordinary and trifling occurrence, had it not been the prelude of a mighty revolution. These robbers were the apostles of Muhammad. Their fanatic valor had emerged from the desert, and in the last 8 years of his reign, Heraclius lost to the Arabs the same provinces which he had rescued from the Persians.
Chapter 47. Ecclesiastical Discord. Theological History of the Doctrine of the Incarnation. The Human and Divine Nature of Christ. Enmity of the Patriarchs of Alexandria and Constantinople. Saint Cyril and Nestorius. Third General Council of Ephesus. Heresy of Eutyches. Fourth General Council of Chalcedon. Civil and Ecclesiastical Discord. Intolerance of Justinian. The Three Chapters. The Monotheolite Controversy. State of the Oriental Sects. The Nestorians. The Jacobites. The Maronites. The Armenians. The Copts and Abyssinians. After the extinction of paganism, the Christians, in peace and piety, might have enjoyed their solitary triumph. But the principle of discord was alive in their bosom, and they were more solicitous to explore the nature than to practice the laws of their founder. I have already observed that the disputes of the Trinity were succeeded by those of the Incarnation, alike scandalous to the Church, alike pernicious to the state, still more minute in their origin, still more durable in their effects. It is my design to comprise in the present chapter a religious war of 250 years, to represent the ecclesiastical and political schism of the Oriental sects, and to introduce their clamorous or sanguinary contests by modest inquiry into the doctrines of the primitive church. A laudable regard for the honor of the first proselyte has countenanced the belief, the hope, the wish, that the Ebionites, or at least the Nazarenes, were distinguished only by their obstinate perseverance in the practice of the Mosaic rites. Their churches have disappeared. Their books are obliterated. Their obscure freedom might allow a latitude of faith, and the softness of their infant creed would be variously molded by the zeal or prudence of 300 years. Yet the most charitable criticism must refuse these sectaries any knowledge of the pure and proper divinity of Christ. Educated in the school of Jewish prophecy and prejudice, they had never been taught to elevate their hopes above a human and temporal Messiah. If they had courage to hail their king when he appeared in a plebeian garb, their grosser apprehensions were incapable of discerning their God, who had studiously disguised his celestial character under the name and person of a mortal. The familiar companions of Jesus of Nazareth conversed with their friend and countryman, who in all the actions of rational and animal life appeared of the same species with themselves. His progress from infancy to youth and manhood was marked by regular increase in stature and wisdom, and after a painful agony of mind and body, he expired on the cross. He lived and died for the service of mankind. But the life and death of Socrates had likewise been devoted to the cause of religion and justice. And although the Stoic or the hero may disdain the humble virtues of Jesus, the tears which he shed over his friend and country may be esteemed the purest evidence of his humanity. The miracles of the gospel could not astonish a people who held with intrepid faith the more splendid prodigies of the Mosaic law. The prophets of ancient days had cured diseases, raised the dead, divided the sea, stopped the sun, and ascended to heaven in a fiery chariot. And the metaphorical style of the Hebrews might ascribe to a saint and martyr the adoptive title of Son of God. Yet in the insufficient creed of the Nazarenes and the Ebionites, a distinction is faintly noticed between the heretics who confounded the generation of Christ in the common order of nature and the less guilty schismatics who revered the virginity of his mother and excluded the aid of an earthly father. The incredulity of the former was countenanced by the visible circumstances of his birth, the legal marriage of the reputed parents, Joseph and Mary, and his lineal claim to the kingdom of David and the inheritance of Judah. But the secret and authentic history has been recorded in several copies of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, which these sectaries long preserved in the original Hebrew as the sole evidence of their faith. The natural suspicions of the husband, conscious of his own chastity, were dispelled by the assurance in a dream that his wife was pregnant of the Holy Ghost. And as this distant and domestic prodigy could not fall under the personal observation of the historian, he must have listened to the same voice which dictated to Isaiah the future conception of a virgin. The son of a virgin, generated by the ineffable operation of the Holy Spirit, was a creature without example or resemblance, superior in every attribute of mind and body to the children of Adam. Since the introduction of the Greek or Chaldean philosophy, the Jews were persuaded of the pre-existence, transmigration, and immortality of souls. And providence was justified by supposition that they were confined in their earthly prisons to expiate the sins which they had contracted in a former state. But the degrees of purity and corruption are almost immeasurable. It might be fairly presumed that the most sublime and virtuous of human spirits was infused into the offspring of Mary and the Holy Ghost, that his abasement was the result of his voluntary choice, and that the object of his mission was to purify not his own, but the sins of the world. On his return to his native skies, he received the immense reward of his obedience, the everlasting kingdom of the Messiah, which had been darkly foretold by the prophets under the carnal images of peace, of conquest, and of dominion. Omnipotence could enlarge the human faculties of Christ to the extent of his celestial office. In the language of antiquity, the title of God has not been severely confined to the first parent, and his incomparable minister, his only begotten son, might claim, without presumption, the religious, though secondary, worship of a subject of a subject world. The seeds of the faith which had slowly arisen in the rocky and ungrateful soil of Judea were transplanted in full maturity to the happier climes of the Gentiles, and the strangers of Rome or Asia, who never beheld the manhood, were the more readily disposed to embrace the divinity of Christ. The polytheist and the philosopher, the Greek and the barbarian, were alike accustomed to conceive a long succession, an infinite chain of angels or demons or deities or eons or emanations issuing from the throne of light. Nor could it seem strange or incredible that the first of these eons, the Logos, or Word of God, of the same substance with the Father, should descend upon earth to deliver the human race from vice and error, and to conduct them in the paths of life and immortality. But the prevailing doctrine of the eternity and inherent pravity of matter infected the primitive churches of the East. Many among the Gentile proselytes refused to believe that a celestial spirit, an undivided portion of the first essence, had been personally united with a mass of impure and contaminated flesh. And in their zeal for the divinity, they piously abjured the humanity of Christ. While his blood was still recent on Mount Calvary, the Docetes, a numerous and learned sect of Asiatics, invented the fantastic system, which was afterwards propagated by the Marcionites, the Manichaeans, and the various names of the Gnostic heresy. They denied the truth and authenticity of the Gospels as far as they relate the conception of Mary, the birth of Christ, and the 30 years that preceded the exercise of his ministry. He first appeared on the banks of the Jordan in the form of perfect manhood, but it was a form only, and not a substance. A human figure created by the hand of omnipotence to imitate the faculties and actions of a man, and to impose a perpetual illusion on the senses of his friends and enemies. The articulate sounds vibrated on the ears of the disciples, but the image which was impressed on their optic nerve eluded the more stubborn evidence of the touch, and they enjoyed the spiritual and not the corporeal presence of the Son of God. The rage of the Jews was idly wasted against an impassive phantom, and the mystic scenes of the passion and death, the resurrection and ascension of Christ, were represented on the theatre of Jerusalem for the benefit of mankind. If it were urged that such ideal mimicry, such incessant deception, was unworthy of the God of truth, the Docetes agreed with too many of their orthodox brethren in the justification of pious falsehood. In the system of the Gnostics, the Jehovah of Israel, the creator of this lower world, was a rebellious, or at least an ignorant, spirit. The Son of God descended upon earth to abolish his temple and his law, and for the accomplishment of this salutary end, he dexterously transferred to his own person the hope and prediction of a temporal Messiah. One of the most subtle disputants of the Manichaean school has pressed the danger and indecency of supposing that the God of the Christians, in the state of a human fetus, emerged at the end of 9 months from a female womb. The pious horror of his antagonists provoked them to disclaim all sensual circumstances of conception and delivery, to maintain that the divinity passed through Mary like a sunbeam through a plate of glass, and to assert that the seal of her virginity remained unbroken, even at the moment when she became the mother of Christ. But the rashness of these concessions has encouraged a milder sentiment of those of the Docetes, who taught not that Christ was a phantom, but that he was clothed with an impassible and incorruptible body. Such indeed, in the more orthodox system, he has acquired since his resurrection, and such he must have always possessed, if it were capable of pervading, without resistance or injury, the density of intermediate matter. Devoid of its most essential properties, it might be exempt from the attributes and infirmities of the flesh. A fetus that could increase from an invisible point to its full maturity. A child that could attain the stature of perfect manhood without deriving any nourishment from the ordinary sources, might continue to exist without repairing a daily waste by daily supply of external matter. Jesus might share the repasts of his disciples without being subject to the calls of thirst or hunger. And his virgin purity was never sullied by the involuntary stains of sensual concupiscence. Of a body thus singularly constituted, a question would arise by what means and of what materials it was originally framed, and our sounder theology is startled by an answer which was not peculiar to the Gnostics, that both the form and the substance proceeded from the divine essence. The idea of pure and absolute spirit is a refinement of modern philosophy. The incorporeal essence, ascribed by the ancients to human souls, celestial beings, and even the deity himself, does not exclude the notion of extended space, and their imagination was satisfied with a subtle nature of air, or fire, or ether, incomparably more perfect than the grossness of the material world. If we define the place, we must describe the figure of the deity. Our experience, perhaps our vanity, represents the powers of reason and virtue under a human form. the anthropomorphites, who swarmed among the monks of Egypt and the Catholics of Africa, could produce the express declaration of Scripture that man was made after the image of his Creator. The venerable Serapion, one of the saints of the Nitrian deserts, relinquished with many a tear his darling prejudice, and bewailed like an infant his unlucky conversion, which had stolen away his God, and left his mind without any visible object of faith or devotion. Such were the fleeting shadows of the Dacetes. A more substantial, though less simple, hypothesis was contrived by Corinthus of Asia, who dared to oppose the last of the apostles. Placed on the confines of the Jewish and Gentile world, he labored to reconcile the Gnostic with the Ebionite by confessing in the same Messiah the supernatural union of a man and a god. And this mystic doctrine was adopted with many fanciful improvements by Carpocrates, Basilides, and Valentine, the heretics of the Egyptian school. In their eyes, Jesus of Nazareth was a mere mortal, the legitimate son of Joseph and Mary. But he was the best and wisest of the human race, selected as the worthy instrument to restore upon earth the worship of the true and supreme deity. When he was baptized in the Jordan, the Christ, the first of the eons, the Son of God himself, descended on Jesus in the form of a dove to inhabit his mind and direct his actions during the allotted period of his ministry. When the Messiah was delivered into the hands of the Jews, the Christ, an immortal and impassible being, forsook his earthly tabernacle, flew back to the Pleroma, or world of spirits, and left the solitary Jesus to suffer, to complain, and to expire. But the justice and generosity of such a desertion are strongly questionable, and the fate of an innocent martyr, that first impelled and at length abandoned by his divine companion, might provoke the pity and indignation of the profane. Their murmurs were variously silenced by the sectaries who espoused and modified the double system of Corinthus. It was alleged that when Jesus was nailed to the cross, he was endowed with a miraculous apathy of mind and body, which rendered him insensible of his apparent sufferings. It was affirmed that these momentary, though real, pangs would be abundantly repaid by the temporal reign of 1,000 years reserved for the Messiah in his kingdom of the New Jerusalem. It was insinuated that if he suffered, he deserved to suffer, that human nature is never absolutely perfect, and that the cross and passion might serve to expiate the venial transgressions of the son of Joseph before his mysterious union with the Son of God. All those who believe the immateriality of the soul, a specious and noble tenet, must confess, from their present experience, the incomprehensible union of mind and matter. A similar union is not inconsistent with a much higher or even with the highest degree of mental faculties, and the incarnation of an aeon or archangel, the most perfect of created spirits, does not involve any positive contradiction or absurdity. In the age of religious freedom, which was determined by the Council of Nice, the dignity of Christ was measured by private judgment according to the indefinite rule of Scripture or reason or tradition. But when his pure and proper divinity had been established on the ruins of Arianism, the faith of the Catholics trembled on the edge of a precipice where it was impossible to recede, dangerous to stand, dreadful to fall, and the manifold inconveniences of their creed were aggravated by the sublime character of their theology. They hesitated to pronounce that God himself, the second person of an equal and consubstantial Trinity, was manifested in the flesh, that a being who pervades the universe had been confined in the womb of Mary, that his eternal duration had been marked by the days and months and years of human existence, that the Almighty had been scourged and crucified, that his impassible essence had felt pain and anguish, that his omniscience was not exempt from ignorance, and that the source of life and immortality expired on Mount Calvary. These alarming consequences were affirmed with unblushing simplicity by Apollinaris, bishop of Laodicea, and one of the luminaries of the church. The son of a learned grammarian, he was skilled in all the sciences of Greece, eloquence, erudition, and philosophy. Conspicuous in the volumes of Apollinaris were humbly devoted to the service of religion. The worthy friend of Athanasius, the worthy antagonist of Julian, he bravely wrestled with the Arians and polytheists, and though he affected the rigor of geometrical demonstration, his commentaries reveal the literal and allegorical sense of the scriptures. A mystery which had long floated in the looseness of popular belief was defined by his perverse diligence in a technical form, and he first proclaimed the memorable words, "One incarnate nature of Christ," which are still re-echoed with hostile clamors in the churches of Asia, Egypt, and Ethiopia. He taught that the Godhead was united or mingled with the body of a man, and that the Logos, the eternal wisdom, supplied in the flesh the place and office of a human soul. Yet as the profound doctor had been terrified at his own rashness, Apollinaris was heard to mutter some faint accents of excuse and explanation. He acquiesced in the old distinction of the Greek philosophers between the rational and sensitive soul of man, that he might reserve the Logos for intellectual functions and employ the subordinate human principle in the meaner actions of animal life. With the moderate Docetes, he revered Mary as the spiritual rather than as the carnal mother of Christ, whose body either came from heaven, impassible and incorruptible, or was absorbed, and as it were transformed, into the essence of the deity. The system of Apollinaris was strenuously encountered by the Asiatic and Syrian divines, whose schools are honored by the names of Basil, Gregory, and Chrysostom, and tainted by those of Diodorus, Theodore, and Nestorius. But the person of the aged bishop of Laodicea, his character and dignity, remained inviolate, and his rivals, since we may not suspect them of the weakness of toleration, were astonished, perhaps, by the novelty of the argument, and diffident of the final sentence of the Catholic Church. A judgment at length inclined in their favor. The heresy of Apollinaris was condemned, and the separate congregations of his disciples were prescribed by the imperial laws. But his principles were secretly entertained in the monasteries of Egypt, and his enemies felt the hatred of Theophilus and Cyril, the successive patriarchs of Alexandria. The groveling Ebionite and the fantastic Docetes were rejected and forgotten. The recent zeal against the errors of Apollinaris reduced the Catholics to a seeming agreement with the double nature of Carinthus. But instead of a temporary and occasional alliance, they established, and we still embrace, the substantial, indissoluble, and everlasting union of a perfect God with a perfect man, of the second person of the Trinity with a reasonable soul and human flesh. In the beginning of the 5th century, the unity of the two natures was the prevailing doctrine of the Church. On all sides it was confessed that the mode of their coexistence could neither be represented by our ideas nor expressed by our language. Yet a secret and incurable discord was cherished between those who were most apprehensive of confounding and those who were most fearful of separating the divinity and the humanity of Christ. Impelled by religious frenzy, they fled with adverse haste from the error which they mutually deemed most destructive of truth and salvation. On either hand, they were anxious to guard, they were jealous to defend, the union and the distinction of the two natures, and to invent such forms of speech, such symbols of doctrine, as were least susceptible of doubt or ambiguity. The poverty of ideas and language tempted them to ransack art and nature for every possible comparison, and each comparison misled their fancy in the explanation of an incomparable mystery. In the polemic microscope, an atom is enlarged to a monster, and each party was skillful to exaggerate the absurd or impious conclusions that might be extorted from the principles of their adversaries. To escape from each other, they wandered through many a dark and devious thicket, till they were astonished by the horrid phantoms of Carinthus and Apollinaris, who guarded the opposite issues of the theological labyrinth. As soon as they beheld the twilight of sense and heresy, they started, measured back their steps, and were again involved in the gloom of impenetrable orthodoxy. To purge themselves from the guilt or reproach of damnable error, they disavowed their consequences, explained their principles, excused their indiscretions, and unanimously pronounced the sounds of concord and faith. Yet a latent and almost invisible spark still lurked among the embers of controversy. By the breath of prejudice and passion, it was quickly kindled to a mighty flame, and the verbal disputes of the Oriental sects have shaken the pillars of the church and state. The name of Cyril of Alexandria is famous in controversial story, and the title of saint is a mark that his opinions and his party have finally prevailed. In the house of his uncle, the Archbishop Theophilus, he imbibed the orthodox lessons of zeal and dominion, and 5 years of his youth were profitably spent in the adjacent monasteries of Nitria. Under the tuition of the abbot Serapion, he applied himself to ecclesiastical studies with such indefatigable ardor that in the course of one sleepless night he has perused the four Gospels, the Catholic Epistles, and the Epistle to the Romans. Or again, he detested, but the writings of Clemens and Dionysius, of Athanasius and Basil, were continually in his hands. By the theory and practice of dispute, his faith was confirmed and his wit was sharpened. He extended round his cell the cobwebs of scholastic theology, and meditated the works of allegory and metaphysics, whose remains in 7 verbose folios now peaceably slumber by the side of their rivals. Cyril prayed and fasted in the desert, but his thoughts, it is the reproach of a friend, were still fixed on the world, and the call of Theophilus, who summoned him to the tumult of cities and synods, was too readily obeyed by the aspiring hermit. With the approbation of his uncle, he assumed the office and acquired the fame of a popular preacher. His comely person adorned the pulpit, the harmony of his voice resounded in the cathedral. His friends were stationed to lead or second the applause of the congregation, and the hasty notes of the scribes preserved his discourses, which in their effect, though not in their composition, might be compared with those of the Athenian orators. The death of Theophilus expanded and realized the hopes of his nephew. The clergy of Alexandria was divided. The soldiers and their general supported the claims of the archdeacon, but a restless multitude with voices and with hands asserted the cause of their favorite, and after a period of 39 years, Cyril was seated on the throne of Athanasius. The prize was not unworthy of his ambition. At a distance from the court and at the head of an immense capital, the patriarch, as he was now styled, of Alexandria, had gradually usurped the state and authority of a civil magistrate. The public and private charities of the city were blindly obeyed by his numerous and fanatic parabolani, familiarized in their daily office with scenes of death, and the prefects of Egypt were awed or provoked by the temporal power of these Christian pontiffs. Ardent in the prosecution of heresy, Cyril auspiciously opened his reign by oppressing the Novatians, the most innocent and harmless of the sectaries. The interdiction of their religious worship appeared in his eyes a just and meritorious act, and he confiscated their holy vessels without apprehending the guilt of sacrilege. The toleration and even the privileges of the Jews, who had multiplied to the number of 40,000, were secured by the laws of the Caesars and Ptolemies, and a long prescription of 700 years since the foundation of Alexandria. Without any legal sentence, without any royal mandate, the patriarch, at the dawn of day, led a seditious multitude to the attack of the synagogues. Unarmed and unprepared, the Jews were incapable of resistance. Their houses of prayer were levelled with the ground, and the episcopal warrior, after rewarding his troops with the plunder of their goods, expelled from the city the remnant of the unbelieving nation. Perhaps he might plead the insolence of their prosperity and their deadly hatred of the Christians, whose blood they had recently shed in a malicious or accidental tumult. Such crimes would have deserved the animadversion of the magistrate, but in this promiscuous outrage the innocent were confounded with the guilty, and Alexandria was impoverished by the loss of a wealthy and industrious colony. The zeal of Cyril exposed him to the penalties of the Julian law, but in a feeble government and a superstitious age, he was secure of impunity and even of praise. Orestes complained, but his just complaints were too quickly forgotten by the ministers of Theodosius, and too deeply remembered by a priest who affected to pardon and continued to hate the prefect of Egypt. As he passed through the streets, his chariot was assaulted by a band of 500 of the Nitrian monks. His guards fled from the wild beasts of the desert. His protestations that he was a Christian and a Catholic were answered by a volley of stones, and the face of Orestes was covered with blood. The loyal citizens of Alexandria hastened to his rescue. He instantly satisfied his justice and revenge against the monk, by whose hand he had been wounded, and Ammonius expired under the rod of the lictor. At the command of Cyril, his body was raised from the ground and transported in solemn procession to the cathedral. The name of Ammonius was changed to that of Thaumasius the Wonderful. His tomb was decorated with the trophies of martyrdom, and the patriarch ascended the pulpit to celebrate the magnanimity of an assassin and a rebel. Such honors might incite the faithful to combat and die under the banners of the saint. And he soon prompted or accepted the sacrifice of a virgin who professed the religion of the Greeks and cultivated the friendship of Orestes. Hypatia, the daughter of Phaon, the mathematician, was initiated in her father's studies. Her learned comments have elucidated the geometry of Apollonius and Diophantus, and she publicly taught, both at Athens and Alexandria, the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle. In the bloom of beauty and in the maturity of wisdom, the modest maid refused her lovers and instructed her disciples. The persons most illustrious for their rank or merit were impatient to visit the female philosopher, and Cyril beheld with a jealous eye the gorgeous train of horses and slaves who crowded the door of her academy. A rumor was spread among the Christians that the daughter of Phaon was the only obstacle to the reconciliation of the prefect and the archbishop, and that obstacle was speedily removed. On a fatal day in the holy season of Lent, Hypatia was torn from her chariot, stripped naked, dragged to the church, and inhumanly butchered by the hands of Peter the Reader and a troop of savage and merciless fanatics. Her flesh was scraped from her bones with sharp oyster shells, and her quivering limbs were delivered to the flames. The just progress of inquiry and punishment was stopped by seasonable gifts, but the murder of Hypatia has imprinted an indelible stain on the character and religion of Cyril of Alexandria. Superstition, perhaps, would more gently expiate the blood of a virgin than the banishment of a saint, and Cyril had accompanied his uncle to the iniquitous synod of the oak. When the memory of Chrysostom was restored and consecrated, the nephew of Theophilus, at the head of a dying faction, still maintained the justice of his sentence. Nor was it till after a tedious delay and an obstinate resistance that he yielded to the consent of the Catholic world. His enmity to the Byzantine pontiffs was a sense of interest, not a sally of passion. He envied their fortunate station in the sunshine of the imperial court, and he dreaded their upstart ambition, which oppressed the metropolitans of Europe and Asia, invaded the provinces of Antioch and Alexandria, and measured their diocese by the limits of the empire. The long moderation of Atticus, the mild usurper of the throne of Chrysostom, suspended the animosities of the Eastern patriarchs. But Cyril was at length awakened by the exultation of a rival more worthy of his esteem and hatred. After the short and troubled reign of Sicinius, bishop of Constantinople, the factions of the clergy and people were appeased by the choice of the emperor, who on this occasion consulted the voice of fame and invited the merit of a stranger. Nestorius, native of Germanicia and a monk of Antioch, was recommended by the austerity of his life and the eloquence of his sermons. But the first homily which he preached before the devout Theodosius betrayed the acrimony and impatience of his zeal. "Give me, O Caesar," he exclaimed, "give me the earth purged of heretics, and I will give you in exchange the kingdom of heaven. Exterminate with me the heretics, and with you I will exterminate the Persians." On the fifth day, as if the treaty had been already signed, the Patriarch of Constantinople discovered, surprised, and attacked a secret conventicle of the Arians. They preferred death to submission. The flames that were kindled by their despair soon spread to the neighboring houses, and the triumph of Nestorius was clouded by the name of incendiary. On either side of the Hellespont, his episcopal vigor imposed a rigid formulary of faith and discipline. A chronological error concerning the festival of Easter was punished as an offense against the church and state. Lydia and Caria, Sardis and Miletus, were purified with the blood of the obstinate quarter decimons. And the edict of the emperor, or rather of the patriarch, enumerates 23 degrees and denominations in the guilt and punishment of heresy. But the sword of persecution which Nestorius so furiously wielded was soon turned against his own breast. Religion was the pretense, but in the judgment of a contemporary saint, ambition was the genuine motive of episcopal warfare. In the Syrian school, Nestorius had been taught to abhor the confusion of the two natures, and nicely to discriminate the humanity of his master Christ from the divinity of the Lord Jesus. The Blessed Virgin he revered as the Mother of Christ, but his ears were offended with the rash and recent title of Mother of God, which had been insensibly adopted since the origin of the Arian controversy. From the pulpit of Constantinople, a friend of the Patriarch, and afterwards the Patriarch himself, repeatedly preached against the use or the abuse of the word, unknown to the apostles, unauthorized by the Church, and which could only tend to alarm the timorous, to mislead the simple, to amuse the profane, and to justify by a seeming resemblance the old genealogy of Olympus. In his calmer moments, Nestorius confessed that it might be tolerated or excused by the union of the two natures, and the communication of their idioms. But he was exasperated, by contradiction, to disclaim the worship of a newborn, an infant deity, to draw his inadequate similes from the conjugal or civil partnerships of life, and to describe the manhood of Christ as the robe, the instrument, the tabernacle of his Godhead. At these blasphemous sounds, the pillars of the sanctuary were shaken. The unsuccessful competitors of Nestorius indulged their pious or personal resentment. The Byzantine clergy was secretly displeased with the intrusion of a stranger. Whatever is superstitious or absurd might claim the protection of the monks, and the people were interested in the glory of their virgin patroness. The sermons of the archbishop and the service of the altar were disturbed by seditious clamor. His authority and doctrine were renounced by separate congregations. Every wind scattered round the empire the leaves of controversy, and the voice of the combatants on a sonorous theatre re-echoed in the cells of Palestine and Egypt. It was the duty of Cyril to enlighten the zeal and ignorance of his innumerable monks. In the school of Alexandria he had imbibed and professed the incarnation of one nature, and the successor of Athanasius consulted his pride and ambition when he rose in arms against another Arius, more formidable and more guilty, on the second throne of the hierarchy. After a short correspondence in which the rival prelates disguised their hatred in the hollow language of respect and charity, the Patriarch of Alexandria denounced to the prince and people, to the east and to the west, the damnable errors of the Byzantine pontiff. From the east, more especially from Antioch, he obtained the ambiguous counsels of toleration and silence, which were addressed to both parties while they favored the cause of Nestorius. But the Vatican received with open arms the messengers of Egypt. The vanity of Celestine was flattered by the appeal, and the partial version of a monk decided the faith of the Pope, who with his Latin clergy was ignorant of the language, the arts, and the theology of the Greeks. At the head of an Italian synod, Celestine weighed the merits of the cause, approved the creed of Cyril, condemned the sentiments and person of Nestorius, degraded the heretic from his episcopal dignity, allowed a respite of 10 days for recantation and penance, and delegated to his enemy the execution of this rash and illegal sentence. But the Patriarch of Alexandria, while he darted the thunders of a god, exposed the errors and passions of a mortal, and his 12 anathemas still torture the orthodox slaves who adore the memory of a saint without forfeiting their allegiance to the Synod of Chalcedon. These bold assertions are indelibly tinged with the colors of the Apollinarian heresy, but the serious and perhaps the sincere professions of Nestorius have satisfied the wiser and less partial theologians of the present times. Yet neither the emperor nor the primate of the East were disposed to obey the mandate of an Italian priest, and a synod of the Catholic, or rather of the Greek Church, was unanimously demanded as the sole remedy that could appease or decide this ecclesiastical quarrel. Ephesus, on all sides accessible by sea and land, was chosen for the place, the festival of Pentecost for the day of the meeting. A writ of summons was dispatched to each metropolitan, and a guard was stationed to protect and confine the fathers till they should settle the mysteries of heaven and the faith of the earth. Nestorius appeared not as a criminal, but as a judge. He depended on the weight rather than the number of his prelates, and his sturdy slaves from the baths of Zeuxippus were armed for every service of injury or defense. But his adversary, Cyril, was more powerful in the weapons both of the flesh and of the spirit. Disobedient to the letter, or at least to the meaning, of the royal summons, he was attended by 50 Egyptian bishops, who expected from their patriarch's nod the inspiration of the Holy Ghost. He had contracted an intimate alliance with Memnon, bishop of Ephesus. The despotic primate of Asia disposed of the ready succors of 30 or 40 episcopal votes. A crowd of peasants, the slaves of the church, was poured into the city to support with blows and clamors a metaphysical argument, and the people zealously asserted the honor of the Virgin, whose body reposed within the walls of Ephesus. The fleet which had transported Cyril from Alexandria was laden with the riches of Egypt, and he disembarked a numerous body of mariners, slaves, and fanatics, enlisted with blind obedience under the banner of Saint Mark and the Mother of God. The fathers and even the guards of the council were awed by this martial array. The adversaries of Cyril and Mary were insulted in the streets, or threatened in their houses. His eloquence and liberality made a daily increase in the number of his adherents, and the Egyptian soon computed that he might command the attendance and the voices of 200 bishops. But the author of the 12 anathemas foresaw and dreaded the opposition of John of Antioch, who, with a small but respectable train of metropolitans and divines, was advancing by slow journeys from the distant capital of the East. Impatient of a delay which he stigmatized as voluntary and culpable, Cyril announced the opening of the synod 16 days after the festival of Pentecost. Nestorius, who depended on the near approach of his eastern friends, persisted, like his predecessor Chrysostom, to disclaim the jurisdiction and to disobey the summons of his enemies. They hastened his trial, and his accuser presided in the seat of judgment. 68 bishops, 22 of metropolitan rank, defended his cause by modest and temperate protest. They were excluded from the councils of their brethren. Candidian, in the emperor's name, requested a delay of 4 days. The profane magistrate was driven with outrage and insult from the assembly of the saints. The whole of this momentous transaction was crowded into the compass of a summer's day. The bishops delivered their separate opinions, but the uniformity of style reveals the influence or the hand of a master who has been accused of corrupting the public evidence of their acts and subscriptions. Without a dissenting voice, they recognized in the epistles of Cyril the Nicene Creed and the doctrine of the fathers. But the partial extracts from the letters and homilies of Nestorius were interrupted by curses and anathemas, and the heretic was degraded from his episcopal and ecclesiastical dignity. The sentence, maliciously inscribed to the new Judas, was affixed and proclaimed in the streets of Ephesus. The weary prelates, as they issued from the church of the Mother of God, were saluted as her champions, and her victory was celebrated by the illuminations, the songs, and the tumult of the night. On the 5th day, the triumph was clouded by the arrival and indignation of the eastern bishops. In a chamber of the inn, before he had wiped the dust from his shoes, John of Antioch gave audience to Candidian, the imperial minister, who related his ineffectual efforts to prevent or to annul the hasty violence of the Egyptian. With equal haste and violence, the Oriental Synod of 50 bishops degraded Cyril and Memnon from their episcopal honors, condemned in the 12 anathemas the purest venom of the Apollinarian heresy, and described the Alexandrian primate as a monster, born and educated for the destruction of the Church. His throne was distant and inaccessible, but they instantly resolved to bestow on the flock of Ephesus the blessing of a faithful shepherd. By the vigilance of Memnon, the churches were shut against them, and a strong garrison was thrown into the cathedral. The troops, under the command of Candidian, advanced to the assault. The outguards were routed and put to the sword, but the place was impregnable. The besiegers retired. Their retreat was pursued by a vigorous sally. They lost their horses, and many of their soldiers were dangerously wounded with clubs and stones. Ephesus, the city of the Virgin, was defiled with rage and clamor, with sedition and blood. The rival synods darted anathemas and excommunications from their spiritual engines, and the court of Theodosius was perplexed by the adverse and contradictory narratives of the Syrian and Egyptian factions. During a busy period of 3 months, the emperor tried every method, except the most effectual means of indifference and contempt, to reconcile this theological quarrel. He attempted to remove or intimidate the leaders by a common sentence of acquittal or condemnation. He invested his representatives at Ephesus with ample power and military force. He summoned from either party 8 chosen deputies to a free and candid conference in the neighborhood of the capital, far from the contagion of popular frenzy. But the Orientals refused to yield, and the Catholics, proud of their numbers and of their Latin allies, rejected all terms of union or toleration. The patience of the meek Theodosius was provoked, and he dissolved in anger this episcopal tumult, which at the distance of 13 centuries assumes the venerable aspect of the 3rd Ecumenical Council. "God is my witness," said the pious prince, "that I am not the author of this confusion. His providence will discern and punish the guilty. Return to your provinces, and may your private virtues repair the mischief and scandal of your meeting." They returned to their provinces, but the same passions which had distracted the Synod of Ephesus were diffused over the eastern world. After 3 obstinate and equal campaigns, John of Antioch and Cyril of Alexandria condescended to explain and embrace. But their seeming reunion must be imputed rather to prudence than to reason, to the mutual lassitude rather than to the Christian charity of the patriarchs. The Byzantine pontiff had instilled into the royal ear a baleful prejudice against the character and conduct of his Egyptian rival. An epistle of menace and invective, which accompanied the summons, accused him as a busy, insolent, and envious priest, who perplexed the simplicity of the faith, violated the peace of the church and state, and by his artful and separate addresses to the wife and sister of Theodosius, presumed to suppose or to scatter the seeds of discord in the imperial family. At the stern command of his sovereign, Cyril had repaired to Ephesus, where he was resisted, threatened, and confined by the magistrates in the interest of Nestorius and the Orientals, who assembled the troops of Lydia and Ionia to suppress the fanatic and disorderly train of the patriarch. Without expecting the royal license, he escaped from his guards, precipitately embarked, deserted the imperfect synod, and retired to his episcopal fortress of safety and independence. But his artful emissaries, both in the court and city, successfully labored to appease the resentment and to conciliate the favor of the emperor. The feeble son of Arcadius was alternately swayed by his wife and sister, by the eunuchs and women of the palace. Superstition and avarice were their ruling passions, and the Orthodox chiefs were assiduous in their endeavors to alarm the former and to gratify the latter. Constantinople and the suburbs were sanctified with frequent monasteries, and the holy abbots, Dalmatius and Eutyches, had devoted their zeal and fidelity to the cause of Cyril, the worship of Mary, and the unity of Christ. From the first moment of their monastic life they had never mingled with the world or trod the profane ground of the city. But in this awful moment of the danger of the church, their vow was superseded by a more sublime and indispensable duty. At the head of a long order of monks and hermits, who carried burning tapers in their hands and chanted litanies to the Mother of God, they proceeded from their monasteries to the palace. The people was edified and inflamed by this extraordinary spectacle, and the trembling monarch listened to the prayers and adjurations of the saints, who boldly pronounced that none could hope for salvation unless they embraced the person and the creed of the Orthodox successor of Athanasius. At the same time, every avenue of the throne was assaulted with gold. Under the decent names of eulogies and benedictions, the courtiers of both sexes were bribed according to the measure of their power and rapaciousness. But their incessant demands despoiled the sanctuaries of Constantinople and Alexandria, and the authority of the patriarch was unable to silence the just murmur of his clergy that a debt of £60,000 had already been contracted to support the expense of this scandalous corruption. Pulcheria, who relieved her brother from the weight of an empire, was the firmest pillar of orthodoxy, and so intimate was the alliance between the thunders of the synod and the whispers of the court that Cyril was assured of success if he could displace one eunuch and substitute another in the favor of Theodosius. Yet the Egyptian could not boast of a glorious or decisive victory. The emperor, with unaccustomed firmness, adhered to his promise of protecting the innocence of the Oriental bishops, and Cyril softened his anathemas and confessed, with ambiguity and reluctance, a twofold nature of Christ before he was permitted to satiate his revenge against the unfortunate Nestorius. The rash and obstinate Nestorius, before the end of the synod, was oppressed by Cyril, betrayed by the court, and faintly supported by his eastern friends. A sentiment or fear or indignation prompted him, while it was yet time, to affect the glory of a voluntary abdication. His wish, or at least his request, was readily granted. He was conducted with honor from Ephesus to his old monastery of Antioch, and after a short pause his successors, Maximian and Proclus, were acknowledged as the lawful bishops of Constantinople. But in the silence of his cell, the degraded patriarch could no longer resume the innocence and security of a private monk. The past he regretted. He was discontented with the present, and the future he had reason to dread. The Oriental bishops successively disengaged their cause from his unpopular name, and each day decreased the number of the schismatics who revered Nestorius as the confessor of the faith. After a residence at Antioch of 4 years, the hand of Theodosius subscribed an edict which ranked him with Simon the magician, prescribed his opinions and followers, condemned his writings to the flames, and banished his person first to Petra in Arabia, and at length to Oasis, one of the islands of the Libyan desert. Secluded from the church and from the world, the exile was still pursued by the rage of bigotry and war. A wandering tribe of the Blemmyes, or Nubians, invaded his solitary prison. In their retreat they dismissed a crowd of useless captives. But no sooner had Nestorius reached the banks of the Nile than he would gladly have escaped from a Roman and Orthodox city to the milder servitude of the savages. His flight was punished as a new crime. The soul of the patriarch inspired the civil and ecclesiastical powers of Egypt. The magistrates, the soldiers, the monks devoutly tortured the enemy of Christ and Saint Cyril. And as far as the confines of Ethiopia, the heretic was alternately dragged and recalled, till his aged body was broken by the hardships and accidents of these reiterated journeys. Yet his mind was still independent and erect. The president of Thebais was awed by his pastoral letters. He survived the Catholic tyrant of Alexandria. And after 16 years' banishment, the Synod of Chalcedon would perhaps have restored him to the honors, or at least to the communion, of the church. The death of Nestorius prevented his obedience to their welcome summons, and his dis-ease might afford some color to the scandalous report that his tongue, the organ of blasphemy, had been eaten by the worms. He was buried in a city of Upper Egypt, known by the names of Chemnis, or Panopolis, or Achmim. But the immortal malice of the Jacobites has persevered for ages to cast stones against his sepulchre, and to propagate the foolish tradition that it was never watered by the rain of heaven, which equally descends on the righteous and the ungodly. Humanity may drop a tear on the fate of Nestorius, yet justice must observe that he suffered the persecution which he had approved and inflicted. The death of the Alexandrian primate, after a reign of 32 years, abandoned the Catholics to the intemperance of zeal and the abuse of victory. The monophysite doctrine, one incarnate nature, was rigorously preached in the churches of Egypt and the monasteries of the East. The primitive creed of Apollinarius was protected by the sanctity of Cyril, and the name of Eutyches, his venerable friend, has been applied to the sect most adverse to the Syrian heresy of Nestorius. His rival Eutyches was the abbot or archimandrite or superior of 300 monks, but the opinions of a simple and illiterate recluse might have expired in the cell where he had slept above 70 years, if the resentment or indiscretion of Flavian, the Byzantine pontiff, had not exposed the scandal to the eyes of the Christian world. His domestic synod was instantly convened. Their proceedings were sullied with clamor and artifice, and the aged heretic was surprised into a seeming confession that Christ had not derived his body from the substance of the Virgin Mary. From their partial decree, Eutyches appealed to a general council, and his cause was vigorously asserted by his godson, Chrysaphius, the reigning eunuch of the palace, and his accomplice, Dioscorus, who had succeeded to the throne, the creed, the talents, and the vices of the nephew of Theophilus. By the special summons of Theodosius, the second synod of Ephesus was judiciously composed of 10 metropolitans and 10 bishops from each of the 6 dioceses of the Eastern Empire. Some exceptions of favor or merit enlarged the number to 135, and the Syrian Bosumus, as the chief and representative of the monks, was invited to sit and vote with the successors of the apostles. But the despotism of the Alexandrian patriarch again oppressed the freedom of debate. The same spiritual and carnal weapons were again drawn from the arsenals of Egypt. The Asiatic veterans, a band of archers, served under the orders of Dioscorus, and the more formidable monks, whose minds were inaccessible to reason or mercy, besieged the doors of the cathedral. The general, and as it should seem, the unconstrained voice of the fathers, accepted the faith and even the anathemas of Cyril, and the heresy of the two natures was formally condemned in the persons and writings of the most learned Orientals. May those who divide Christ be divided with the sword. May they be hewn in pieces. May they be burned alive. Were the charitable wishes of a Christian synod. The innocence and sanctity of Eutyches were acknowledged without hesitation, but the prelates, more especially those of Thrace and Asia, were unwilling to depose their patriarch for the use or even the abuse of his lawful jurisdiction. They embraced the knees of Dioscorus as he stood with a threatening aspect on the footstool of his throne, and conjured him to forgive the offences and to respect the dignity of his brother. "Do you mean to raise a sedition?" exclaimed the relentless tyrant. "Where are the officers?" At these words a furious multitude of monks and soldiers, with staves and swords and chains, burst into the church. The trembling bishops hid themselves behind the altar or under the benches, and as they were not inspired with the zeal of martyrdom, they successively subscribed a blank paper, which was afterwards filled with the condemnation of the Byzantine pontiff. Flavian was instantly delivered to the wild beasts of this spiritual amphitheatre. The monks were stimulated by the voice and example of Barsumas to avenge the injuries of Christ. It is said that the Patriarch of Alexandria reviled and buffeted and kicked and trampled his brother of Constantinople. It is certain that the victim, before he could reach the place of his exile, expired on the third day of the wounds and bruises which he had received at Ephesus. This second synod has been justly branded as a gang of robbers and assassins. Yet the accusers of Dioscorus would magnify his violence to alleviate the cowardice and inconstancy of their own behavior. The faith of Egypt had prevailed, but the vanquished party was supported by the same pope who encountered, without fear, the hostile rage of Attila and Genseric. The theology of Leo, his famous tome or epistle on the mystery of the Incarnation, had been disregarded by the Synod of Ephesus. His authority and that of the Latin Church was insulted in his legates who escaped from slavery and death to relate the melancholy tale of the tyranny of Dioscorus and the martyrdom of Flavian. His provincial synod annulled the irregular proceedings of Ephesus, but as this step was itself irregular, he solicited the convocation of a general council in the free and orthodox provinces of Italy. From his independent throne, the Roman bishop spoke and acted without danger as the head of the Christians, and his dictates were obsequiously transcribed by Placidia and her son Valentinian, who addressed their eastern colleague to restore the peace and unity of the church. But the pageant of Oriental royalty was moved with equal dexterity by the hand of the eunuch, and Theodosius could pronounce, without hesitation, that the church was already peaceful and triumphant, and that the recent flame had been extinguished by the just punishment of the Nestorians. Perhaps the Greeks would be still involved in the heresy of the Monophysites if the emperor's horse had not fortunately stumbled. Theodosius expired. His orthodox sister, Pulcheria, with a nominal husband, succeeded to the throne. Chrysaphius was burnt. Dioscorus was disgraced. The exiles were recalled, and the tome of Leo was subscribed by the Oriental bishops. Yet the pope was disappointed in his favorite project of a Latin council. He disdained to preside in the Greek synod, which was speedily assembled at Nice in Bithynia. His legates required in a peremptory tone the presence of the emperor, and the weary fathers were transported to Chalcedon under the immediate eye of a Marcian than the Senate of Constantinople. A quarter of a mile from the Thracian Bosphorus, the Church of St. Euphemia was built on the summit of a gentle, though lofty, ascent. The triple structure was celebrated as a prodigy of art, and the boundless prospect of the land and sea might have raised the mind of a sectary to the contemplation of the God of the universe. 630 bishops were ranged in order in the nave of the church, but the patriarchs of the East were preceded by the legates, of whom the third was a simple priest, and the place of honor was reserved for 20 laymen of consular or senatorial rank. The gospel was ostentatiously displayed in the center, but the rule of faith was defined by the papal and imperial ministers, who moderated the 13 sessions of the Council of Chalcedon. Their partial interposition silenced the intemperate shouts and execrations which degraded the episcopal gravity. But on the formal accusation of the legates, Dioscorus was compelled to descend from his throne to the rank of a criminal, already condemned in the opinion of his judges. The Orientals, less adverse to Nestorius than to Cyril, accepted the Romans as their deliverers. Thrace and Pontus and Asia were exasperated against the murderer of Flavian, and the new patriarchs of Constantinople and Antioch secured their places by the sacrifice of their benefactor. The bishops of Palestine, Macedonia, and Greece were attached to the faith of Cyril, but in the face of the synod, in the heat of the battle, the leaders, with their obsequious train, passed from the right to the left wing, and decided the victory by this seasonable desertion. Of the 17 suffragans who sailed from Alexandria, 4 were tempted from their allegiance, and the 13, falling prostrate on the ground, implored the mercy of the council with sighs and tears and a pathetic declaration that, if they yielded, they should be massacred on their return to Egypt by the indignant people. A tardy repentance was allowed to expiate the guilt or error of the accomplices of Dioscorus, but their sins were accumulated on his head. He neither asked nor hoped for pardon, and the moderation of those who pleaded for a general amnesty was drowned in the prevailing cry of victory and revenge. To save the reputation of his late adherents, some personal offences were skilfully detected. His rash and illegal excommunication of the Pope, and his contumacious refusal, while he was detained a prisoner, to attend to the summons of the synod. Witnesses were introduced to prove the special facts of his pride, avarice, and cruelty, and the fathers heard with abhorrence that the alms of the church were lavished on the female dancers, that his palace and even his bath was open to the prostitutes of Alexandria, and that the infamous Pansophia, or Irene, was publicly entertained as the concubine of the patriarch. For these scandalous offences, Dioscorus was deposed by the synod and banished by the emperor. But the purity of his faith was declared in the presence and with the tacit approbation of the fathers. Their prudence supposed rather than pronounced the heresy of Eutyches, who was never summoned before their tribunal, and they sat silent and abashed when a bold monophysite, casting at their feet a volume of Cyril, challenged them to anathematize in his person the doctrine of the saint. If we fairly peruse the acts of Chalcedon as they are recorded by the Orthodox party, we shall find that a great majority of the bishops embraced the simple unity of Christ, and the ambiguous concession that he was formed of or from two natures might imply either their previous existence or their subsequent confusion, or some dangerous interval between the conception of the man and the assumption of the God. The Roman theology, more positive and precise, adopted the term most offensive to the ears of the Egyptians, that Christ existed in two natures. Then this momentous particle